Let's look at Revelation, Revelation chapter 18. Now, you probably know this first couple lines because you've all heard this like hundreds of times now as we've been doing this. Remember, the Apostle John has been caught up into heaven. And all that he sees, he's seeing kind of from heaven's perspective. He sees Jesus take a scroll from the hand of God, a scroll that has seven seals. And as he breaks each seal and unrolls the scroll a little bit further, one thing after another, things start taking place on the earth. And this seven-year period that we have come so fondly to call the tribulation, is that fond to you? It's not fond to me. It's like... But this period begins to unfold on earth when God's wrath is poured out on the world. When God begins to take all the things that are so wrong and make them so right. I was praying with a friend this morning after first service. And oh my gosh, the things that he's been through. He's lost his job. He's had health problems. Been in an accident. Hit by somebody who has a suspended license and no insurance. He and his wife and his daughter were all in the car. They're wearing neck braces. Oh my gosh. And we wonder, and the guy gave the police, you know, fake ID, no address, no all this kind of stuff. And you think, that's not fair. But you know what? There will be a day when God will fix all those things. God will fix all those things. That's part of what the tribulation is all about. We are now at the end of the seven-year period. Woohoo! Is that a good thing? Yes, I've only got one more ugly, horrible thing, message to give. That's this morning. And then after that, it's all roses and candy and ice cream and things like that when we get to chapter 19. But for now, we got to finish this wrath thing up as John kind of backs steps. In chapter 16, the finality of God's wrath was when he poured out wrath on this thing called Babylon. We backed up and when we got to chapter 17 and talked about how Babylon is a sort of in chapter 17, we see part of what Babylon is about is a false religion that leads people away from the worship of the true and living God. Today in chapter 18, it's all about materialism. It's this thing that we're going to call the world. As believers, we have three main enemies in life. And these might not be the thing that people you're thinking about. You're probably thinking about some guy at work that gives you a hard time or their neighbor next door or something. But our enemies as believers that we all share one common enemy is Satan. He is a spiritual being who hates you and has a terrible plan for your life. Second enemy that we all face is actually the person that stares back at you in the mirror. Your flesh, your own sin nature, that part of us that still wants to disobey God, that part of us that loves to sin. Some of us haven't quite reached the honesty part in our lives where we realize and can admit to people that we love to sin. Because you say, I'm a Christian, I go to church. How's it going, brother? Oh, fine, brother. Just walking with Jesus, I am. And we're lying through our teeth. Because, man, we just did a whopper last night, and oh my gosh, was it fun until it was over. And then we felt so horrible. But we have an enemy of our flesh. I'm going to be in big trouble. I'm going way outside of my notes today. I got to stop this. I got to stay on track here. Okay. The third enemy is the world. In a sense that we're going to talk about material things, this entity that we call the world is an invisible system. It's kind of like the internet. You don't actually see the internet, do you? You look at things that are transmitted through the internet, but you don't really see the internet unless you're some highfalutin network engineer who works on the lines and the computers and all that kind of stuff. But most of us, the internet's just the out there. It's the thing that miraculously takes my email and sends it to somebody I'm addressing to on the other side of the world. How does that work? I don't know, but it's out there. That's kind of the world. It's an invisible system that is used by our flesh, that is used by Satan to tempt us and to draw us away from God. We're going to give it a name today, Babylon, the world. Now, chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Now, if you've been reading your Bible, some of these words might sound familiar, because the Bible talks about the fall of Babylon, because it's something that's already happened. You'll see it in Isaiah 21, 20 something, I don't know. Isaiah talks about it. Jeremiah talks about it. When it says it's become a dwelling place of demons, in Jeremiah's prophecy about Babylon, his prophecy might talk about the fall of ancient Babylon, but there's a lot of it that kind of makes it sneakily suspicious that he's talking about this future thing that we're looking at. Jeremiah 51:37, he writes, Babylon shall become a heap, a dwelling place for jackals, an astonishment and a hissing without an inhabitant. Now, John says, writes down that it's become a dwelling place of demons. New King James says it's a dwelling place of jackals. But as you dig a little deeper, in the Old Testament, in the Jeremiah thing, in the Hebrew word that's translated jackals is tanaim, which means, at least it's what the Hebrew dictionaries tell me, I don't see the word jackal in there. They translate it dragon, serpent, or sea monster. Now, I think some of us are a little bit too sophisticated to believe in dragons, right? Though we've already been reading about the dragon in Revelation 12, the dragon who is, who? Satan. Dragons here, plural. It's kind of like just what John's writing about. Will become a dwelling place for demons. Verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Her wine brings them into fornication, and it will result in wrath. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. The language that he's using speaks about the attraction of the material world. I should probably do a little Madonna thing here. The material girl, right? For the material world. Oh, shoot, I missed that one. I should have thought about that. Gosh, I didn't even think about that first service. Oh, well. I want to talk for a few minutes about the danger of wealth. The world system of Babylon is attractive because it promises to make us wealthy. And I got to tell you that if somebody tells me they want to take my wealth away, that's just downright un-American. Is it? Isn't it? I mean, that's communism. And we don't like communists, do we? I'm not trying to trick you. It's okay to say, we don't like communists. That's right. Amen. Preach it, brother. But be careful, gang, because there's a danger that is attached to wealth. Paul writes to Timothy, but those who desire to be rich. Now, he's not talking about desiring to be me. Those who desire to be rich. I just want to tell you right up front, he's not talking about me, okay? I am rich, but I'm not rich. I am rich in Christ. That's what my friends tell me. Okay? Okay. He's talking about wealth. Those who want to be wealthy, those who desire to be wealthy, fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Now, I got to tell you, you don't have to be in the Fortune 500 top wealthy people of the world to have a love for money, do you? There could be people out on Skid Row who have a love for money. It's not how much money you actually have. It's whether you're desiring it. The love of money can be the root of all kinds of evil. for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and have pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Is the sound up in the back, Linda? In The Lord of the Rings, one of our favorite characters, or not so favorite, we call him initially Gollum, then we learn later that his name was Smeagol. But you find out as you watch the whole series that he didn't actually start off looking like this. There he is. It's my birthday, he says. He wants it. Get ready for the famous line. Two words that he's so famous for. You can say it with me. My precious. That ring, what a picture of the stuff of the world. What a picture of someone who lives for the love of stuff. And what it leads to. Now, is it wrong to have money? Not at all. Not at all. Money can actually be a tool for God to use. Paul writes to Timothy, he says in 1 Timothy 6, verse 17, he says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. The treasure that God has blessed you with can be a tool for God. The real issue is, does God control you, or does your treasures control you? That's really where it's all at. Who's in control? Who calls the shots? You know, it's funny because when we do that offering thing during the service and those big scary guys come up and pass the baskets and glare at you and make you put money in the offering and you think those churches just like all the rest of them and stuff like that. Do you know you actually don't have to give? And in fact, if you've got that kind of an attitude that you're so worried about getting rid of your pennies or whatever, hold on to them for Pete's sake. Giving ought to be something that you do because God is leading you, not because somebody's twisting your arm. But oh, what a blessing it is when we learn to give because God is prompted and because I just, Well, God has blessed me, and I just want to respond to him, whether it's in the offering or giving to somebody else outside the door or my helping my neighbor or whatever. We get so stingy, don't we? We look at our wallets and we say, my precious. Ooh, that hurt, didn't it? Verse 4. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. We're going to come back to this at the end. Verse 5, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. It says her sins have reached to heaven. You could say that God has literally had it up to here with them. I've had it up to here. Now, sometimes when we see bad things happening, we wonder, why hasn't God had it up to here with that person? Because if anybody deserves God to say, I've had it up to here, I've had enough of you, it's that person. Why doesn't God have it up to here? Because it's not time yet, gang. Peter writes in 2 Peter 3:9, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, his promise to come back and his promise to take care of the mess. He's not dragging his heels, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. I don't know, but if Jesus had come back like 50 years ago, how many of us in this room would have been ready? Well, not a lot, because most of you hadn't even been born 50 years ago. Okay. How about if he'd come back 10 years ago? When you were in the middle of your mess. Aren't you glad he waited? Oh, yeah. Verse 6. Render to her just as she had rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine. She will be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxurious with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city of Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. The kings of the earth will stand back. They don't want to get too close because they just watch this thing get wiped out and say, alas, alas. The Greek word is ouai. It means alas or woe. I kind of think you probably should be pronouncing it, oi, 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 they say as they watch this thing burning from a distance. Verse 11, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots. How many horses you got under your hood? And bodies and souls of men. Now this list, merchandise of gold and silver and on and on and on. That's a sample of the stuff of the world. I don't know, when I read this, it's like I'm reading the inventory of the Brea Mall. I mean, doesn't it? I mean, it's all the gift shops and even like verse 13, cinnamon. I mean, that Cinnabon, thing is just downright evil, isn't it? When you walk by it, it's not evil. It's, oh my gosh, it smells so good. This is the stuff of the world. It mentions bodies and souls of men. Now, this might be speaking about the evils of human slavery. Could be. It could be talking about souls, literally, the condition of the souls that are being traded in the world. If you make it your life's goal to get as much of this stuff as possible, your soul is in danger. You're in a dangerous place. If this is your life's work, to have stuff. John writes in 1 John chapter 2, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever." Do you remember this old bumper sticker? You remember seeing this old bumper sticker? "He who dies with the most toys wins." Anybody remember that bumper sticker? Guess what? They lied to you. Shock, horror, they lied to you. Because the truth is, he who dies without God loses. Has nothing to do with how many toys you have or you don't have. It's whether or not you've got God. That's the truth. Verse 14. "The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you. And all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you. And you shall find them no more at all." The words, I wish I had time to unpack some of these words. But he's talking about all the good stuff, all the good life. The word, the phrase rich and splendid, the word rich there, we get our word lipids from, like Lipitor, meaning fat, meaning translation, modern 2012, ice cream. Magnum bars. Have you had the Magnum bars? You got to have the Magnum bar. Oh my gosh, what am I doing? The word splendid, it talks about all the shiny stuff. And he says, you know, it's all going to be gone. The fruit that your soul longed for. Gang, longing for the wrong things. Longing for the wrong things. Is it wrong to have ice cream? Absolutely not, for Pete's sake. Is it wrong to have a shiny ring on your finger? Absolutely not. But is that what you're living for? Does it control you? Loving the wrong things, desiring the wrong things, all that your soul longed for, Caleb, it's epithumia, all that your soul has lusted for. Gotta have it. My precious. Trappers in Africa have developed a simple way of catching those pesky monkeys. And here's how they do this. I want to train you so you too can catch monkeys. I wish this worked with squirrels in our backyard. We've got squirrels in our backyard, pesky squirrels, but this is how you catch monkeys. We don't have a monkey problem. We have squirrel problems. What they do is they will take something like a gourd or a coconut. They'll attach it to a tree. They'll bore a hole in it just big enough for a monkey to squeeze its hand into it. And then they will fill the coconut or the gourd with monkey treats. Now, I don't know if they use M&Ms or Snickers or Almond Joy. Oh my gosh, a Kit Kat bar, Reese's. Oh man, baby, where did I get that picture? I like that. And you fill the gourd, the coconut with it, and they'll reach their hand in because they smell them monkey treats. And monkeys, amazingly, maybe we have descended from monkeys. Because they lust for that stuff so much that when they get a hold of it, they will not let go. and they will stay there all day, all night, all the next day, all the next night, trying to figure out how to hold on to their monkey treat and get their hand out of the gourd, out of the coconut. And all the trapper has to do is take his leisure and wait until, you know, after he's done with his hair appointment and trimming his nails, and go and pick up a few monkeys, because they're not going anywhere, because they won't let go of their monkey treats. Now, I have found that this actually works in New York City.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack Halliday, and I think it's time we discuss something, and that's how to catch a monkey. I know it's been on your mind for quite some time, so let's get down to business. Try chasing one down through Times Square, perhaps. Does not work. Now, in order to do this right, you're going to need a jar. This one here is too small. This one, well, it's big enough, but much too large of an opening. This third one, though, perfect! And you'll soon find out why. So now what you're going to need is an attractive piece of fruit. Something like this. You're going to want it to just fit through the opening of the jar. Where you put the jar, but it doesn't. Just don't ask. Now here comes the good part.
You get where I'm getting with this? What are the monkey treats that catch you? Can you let go of them? That's what the world's all about. It puts those monkey treats out there for you. And we end up going the wrong direction, looking for the wrong things, and we get caught. Verse 15. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls." Alas, alas, there it is again. Oi, oi. Now the merchants are crying out, oi, oi, as they're watching Babylon go up in smoke. Verse 17. For in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who travel by ships, sailors and as many as trade on the sea stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, "What is like this great city?" They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For in 1 hour she is made desolate." And again, there's that word alas again. Oi, oi. Now it's the sailors. That's the third group of people that are crying out, oi, oi. The kings, the merchants, the sailors. As they watch from a distance, and they watch Babylon going up in smoke. As they watch the world going up in smoke. Because this has been their life. This has been their living. Verse 20. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found anymore. A millstone. A mill, an ancient mill, grain mill, consisted of two stones. There'd be a lower stone like this. This is like that. The lower stone there, the big donut type thing, is like about the size of what I'm sitting on the stage. And then there's the upper millstone. Now, whether this is an upper or lower, we don't know. It could be the lower because it says a larger stone. It could be that it's just a big upper stone. But either way, these things are heavy. I mean, you throw something in a pool, you know, throw a little rock in a pool, makes a little splash. You throw something this big, huge splash. The angel is trying to make a point. He picks up something heavy, something weighty, and throws it in. Huge splash to give a sample of what it will be like when Babylon falls. He's giving an example. He's painting a picture with a millstone of what the end will look like. A picture. I've been thinking a lot. Some of you know I've been reading a book on Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The Germans call him Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer. I started watching the movie. And I'm not going to finish the movie until I finish the book. Pastor in Germany that was imprisoned by Hitler. And I'm learning a lot about World War II. I'm learning a lot about Germany that I didn't have a clue about. I've been watching the rise of Hitler from the early 30s. And it's not what I thought it would be. It's not what I thought it would be at all. Here's a clip that dates back to 1933. This is before the world thought that he was evil, when most people thought he was good because he was anti-communist. The Germans loved him because Germany had been humiliated after World War I, and Germany did not like the deal they got. And this guy promised to rebuild their nation. It was like it's like a Chevrolet commercial. Baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. That's what makes America great. Well, listening to him would sound an awful lot like that. When you listen, I don't know German. I wish I did. But I've watched clips of him with the subtext in English. He's speaking like an evangelist. He's telling people, he's asking that God for help. I mean, national pride, God, what's wrong with that? That's Hitler. You know, we have learned to think of the swastika as being like a sign of pure evil. Those of you who know this sign, pure evil. Oh my gosh, Hitler, evil. How could these people wave these things around? That's only because we've reinterpreted it according to what we've seen Hitler. The swastika goes back to ancient India. It's a sign of good luck. And he took what was meant to be good, and we now think of it as being evil. When he rose to power, the world, a lot of people left him. It took a lot of the people in Germany a long time to realize what they had bought into. That is exactly like the Antichrist. The more I read about Hitler and stuff, I was just like, oh my gosh, a perfect pattern, blueprint for the Antichrist. Now, he wasn't the Antichrist. But you and I have a great picture of what it looks like. Just like the millstone being thrown in, showing the overthrow of Babylon. I think that for some of us, do you remember where you were September 11th, 2001? Do you remember where you were that morning? I do. I remember when I got a call from my wife saying that the news was saying some light plane had flown into the trade center. And then they realized it wasn't a little plane. And then they're watching, and then something else hits. I'm going to show you something. It's disturbing. And I just want to warn you, it's only 26 seconds long. So if you want to close your ears and close your eyes, be my guest. This is Memorial Day. This is Memorial Day weekend. And it's important that we not only remember those who have served us, those who do serve us, those who do serve us, those who have given their lives, but we also remember why they've done these kinds of things. So I'm going to show you a clip from 9/11, and brace yourselves. I must have watched an hour or more of this stuff yesterday, trying to find the right clip, trying to find one without cursing in it, something that I could play at church. But in every clip where there's a live person that you hear the same anguish. The kings, the merchants, and the sailors stand at a distance. And we might kind of chuckle when we hear, oi, oi, oi. But it's not like, oi, oi, oi. No, it's like that. Because those who are caught in the world will respond like that when it goes down. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not trying to say that what happened on 9/11 was God's judgment. Not at all. It was an act of cowardly terrorists. But it painted a picture for us, didn't it? It painted a picture for us of what the fall of Babylon will be like as people stand back from a distance and watch the smoke rise. Are you caught in the world? Have you become so worldly that if Bray Mall goes away, your life is over? We can kind of chuckle at that. Let me make it a little more personal, gentlemen. What if Fry's goes away? No! No! Oi! Oi! Yeah, Home Depot, there you go. Are you catching on to what I'm saying? Possessions are not wrong. Wealth is not wrong until it controls you. Verse 22, the sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. That's the entertainment industry. No craftsman of any craft shall be found in you anymore. The word speaks of sculpting. The sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you anymore. That's industry, the factories running. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you anymore. I mean, don't we hate it when the electricity goes out? And the voice of the bridegroom and bride shall be not heard in you anymore. I mean, nothing more joyous than marriage. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived. And yes, the word for sorcery, pharmakia, there's a hint of drugs in there. And in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. The world system, Babylon, that is against the things of God. I want to end with just a few thoughts, looking back at that one phrase in verse 4, where God says, come out of her. And I want to talk about the Christian and the world. Some people have tried to deal with the world by running away from it. Whether it's running away to Idaho and building a bomb shelter and learning to eat crickets and pine cones and stuff like that. And forgive me, I'm not really trying to mock people too much. Or whether it's running off to some monastery where I don't interface with the world. The problem is that Jesus told us to be lights in the world. Matthew 5:14, he said, "You are the light of the world. A city set on the hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand. And it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." That doesn't sound like isolating yourself. That doesn't sound like running away. That sounds like living right next to your neighbors. That sounds like having your desk right next to that guy that drives you nuts at work and being a light. How else are they going to see? How else are they going to hear about a God who loved them so much that he gave everything? He gave his son to die for them. How else are they going to hear that unless you and I are here in this world? We're supposed to be in the world, but we're not supposed to have too much of the world in us. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. There's a story in Genesis 19 about a fellow named Lot. He was the nephew of Abraham. And he and Abraham were buds. They hung out together. They raised their flocks together till they just got too big, too prosperous, and they had to part ways. Abraham went one way, Lot went another. Lot chose to go live down in the valley of the Jordan River, where everything was luxurious, and where there were some pretty cool places. Like, there was one of those cities where what's done in that city stays in that city, you know, kind of like that. Actually, this place was not called Las Vegas. It was called Sodom. And as you study Genesis 19 and the story there, I can't help but come to the conclusion that Lot learned to have a lot of the world brought into his family. You see it ruining his daughters. You see it ruining his wife. You see his credibility with his family shot to pieces. When the angels show up and try to pull Lot and his family out, they say, "Go get everybody and get out of here." And so it says, and so Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws who had married his daughters and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. Okay, everyone, and the punchline is, I don't remember hearing that knock-knock joke. I don't get it. Two angels knocked on the door, knock-knock. I don't get it. What do you mean? You're just joshing me. Why would they not take him seriously? Probably because he wasn't taking his faith seriously. He seemed to be joking. Flock of wild ducks flying by in formation, heading south for the winter, formed a beautiful V in the sky, admired by everybody down on the ground who saw them. One day, Wally, one of the wild ducks in the formation, spotted something on the ground that caught his eye. It was a barnyard. It was a flock of tame ducks that lived there, and they kind of seemed to be doing okay. They just were waddling around. He could hear them going quack 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 quack, and they didn't have to do much to get fed. There's corn all over the ground. No big, it looked awesome. And he said, "I kind of think that looks like, and he, I like that. I think I want me some of that." And he thought about it. He looked at the barnyard. He looked at the ducks. And he thought, "I think I want to give this a try." And so he made a sharp turn and headed down. Let's see if we can find him heading down. Yeah, there he is. There's Wally. He landed among the tame ducks, began to waddle around and quack merrily. Had a good time. He started eating the corn. The formation of the wild ducks continued their journey south, but Wally didn't care. I'll catch them in a few months when they come back, he said. Several months go by, and sure enough, Wally looked up. He looked up, and there they go! And so he starts flapping his wings furiously. Come on, flap, Wally, flap. It's all crap. Flap, Wally, flap. No, it's a children's story. I shouldn't be telling you. Flap, Wally, flap. There we go. It tries to get off the ground. All it can do is hit the barn door or hit the side of the barn. And he gives up. Well, you know, I'll just wait till they come by the next time. The next time they fly overhead and he tries to get off the ground. Can't do it. And every winter and every spring, they'd fly overhead. Eventually, Wally stopped paying attention to the wild ducks. Hardly even noticed them. Because he had, after all, become a barnyard duck. We could probably call him a Babylon duck. Beloved, don't get caught in the world. Be careful about the entanglements of the world. I'm not saying you don't work to get ahead. I'm not saying you don't earn a good income. I'm not saying you don't take care of your family. Absolutely. Do those things. Absolutely. But let God control your life. Don't let the stuff control your life. God's provided a very cool way of victory for us, a way to conquer the world. 1 John chapter 5 says this, verse 4. For whatever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is he who overcomes the world? But he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. Gang, it's your faith in Jesus Christ that gives you the start on the right foot. He gives you the ability to say no. Holding on to him is what gets us through the door away from the world. Let's stand.